Hello, welcome back to Book Therapy. This is episode 12, I think it is, episode 12. Thanks for listening. Again, you can find me on Twitter at BookTherapy13, Facebook at facebook.com/BookTherapy, and RobCohen13. I think I have a Gmail account, booktherapy13@gmail.com. You can also email me. One of the things I haven't mentioned earlier is that if you like the podcast, go to iTunes and subscribe to it. Subscribing to an iTunes podcast does a couple things. One, it automatically will download to your iTunes whenever a new episode is released. It also will give you an opportunity to post any comments or suggestions, any type of feedback that you want to put onto the iTunes website. Now, what that does is it also helps the podcast get found by other people who may not know about it, but who might possibly be interested in this podcast due to its subject matter. So the way that other podcasts have gotten their notoriety is you go to their podcast and you see, or you go to a podcast you like, and then based on the suggestions, you can find other podcasts. So who knows, maybe some other people who might be interested in this podcast could learn about it by virtue of your subscribing and putting comments to it and things like that. But nevertheless, let's get back to business. It's been a busy reading couple of weeks. Last episode, I think we talked only about Lee Child and Jack Reacher, but I had read three books since then. Actually, three books prior to that podcast. I had finished a fourth one, and now I'm almost done with the fifth book. We're not going to talk about that fifth one yet. We'll take the next episode to spend as much time on that as I think it deserves, but I'm telling you right now, it could very well be one of the best books I've ever read. I'm really that excited about it. But getting back to the books that are first on that list, there have been four. Now, in the past podcasts, I've pretty much gone book by book and given you the synopsis and given you my critique of it and taken a good, 15-20 minutes per book. And I'm not going to do that this time. Frankly, the four books that I've got, or at least wanted to cover, none of them were so fantastic or exciting that would warrant long periods of discussion about them. One of them was called The Frightened Man by Kenneth Cameron, and it bills itself as a Jack the Ripper type mystery, which is what initially attracted my attention to it through an Amazon.com suggestion, a book you might also like to read. And the best description I can use is boring. Just really disappointing, and had very, very little to do with Jack the Ripper. It actually takes place about 10 years after the Jack the Ripper killings in London. And the idea is that Jack the Ripper is back. There's been another prostitute murdered, and there's an eyewitness who comes to the main character, who is an American author, a mystery writer, I believe, who fought in the Civil War and came to London to get away. A witness comes to the main character, the author, and says, I saw him, and it was Jack the Ripper, and he's back. Well, you'd think that would make for an interesting opening and an intriguing story. But unfortunately, it really fell apart from there. There was very little context as far as connection with Jack the Ripper. And the pages flew by simply because I forced them to, because I couldn't wait for it to be over. I think it's the first book in a new series, or at least it's the first book in a series that is a couple books in. I think the book was written in like 2009 or 2010. And just disappointing, and not really going to read any more of those books at all. The next book that I want to talk about was a David Baldacci book called The Hit. As you may recall, I'd gone through a string of books that I was really disappointed in, hadn't really found anything that really excited me, so I figured I'd go back to the basics, go back to the familiar territory of an author that I've read significant amounts of books on. And so David Baldacci's The Hit was the latest release, and so I went to it. Now, as I've mentioned in the past, unlike a Michael Connelly or a Lee Child or a Jonathan Kellerman, David Baldacci is an author who, when his books come out, I buy it immediately, and then it typically sits on my shelf for a couple weeks, if not a month or two, before I actually get to it. And I don't really have a good reason for that, other than it's so familiar territory that there's nothing about the book, regardless of what the story is based on the book jacket, that draws me into the point where I have to put everything aside in order to start this book first. It's strange. all of the books are so terrifically mediocre that it's really like a warm blanket. You know what you're going to get. You know it's not going to be terribly exciting. You know it's not going to be terribly dramatic. You also know it's not going to be like the best literature you've ever read. But it's going to be comfortable. It's going to be one of those rainy day books where you can't find anything else, so you want to wrap up with a nice, warm blanket and sit by the fire, something that's going to be nice, comfy, and cozy, so you get a David Baldacci book. And this one, The Hit, really fell into that mold. I thought it was going to be a little different. It started out like it was going to be something pretty exciting, but it really started to fall into a pattern, the same as all the other Baldacci books fall into a similar type of a pattern. It was predictable. The result, or the resolution of the quote-unquote mystery was a little bit surprising, but nevertheless, it didn't really have any aha surprises to it. And the characters are pretty wooden. There's not terrific amount of dialogue. And so it's just not, it doesn't grab me and hold me, and I'm not still thinking about it days afterwards. A Michael Connelly definitely has that level of detail and that level of depth of character that even if it's a book, a Harry Bosch book, that is just a straightforward mystery as opposed to one of the other the other Harry Bosch novels, which seems to delve a little bit deeper into Harry Bosch's psyche, even when it's just seems to be a straightforward mystery, it still has that grab on you that, you know, days or weeks afterwards, you're still thinking about it. And the Baldacci books are pretty much quote-unquote throwaways in comparison. Now, I've read all of the Baldacci books in order, starting with Absolute Power. And what's interesting is I remember I read Absolute Power in hardcover, and that was the one where it was developed into a movie starring Clint Eastwood, which I thought was pretty poor casting because I think he was too old. But a burglar is robbing a house in Washington, D.C., and it turns out that this is the love nest of the president, where he takes his mistress. And if I recall correctly, while the burglar is in the house robbing the house, the president comes in with his mistress, and then he ends up killing the mistress. And so there's a lot of intrigue and espionage in Washington, D.C. politics and the president and the burglar and things like that. Now, based on the book jacket, it seemed like it would be a really exciting book. And I seem to recall the book just feeling really strong and then falling flat at the end. And so from that point, I think I've always been waiting for Baldacci to come up with a book which really was solid all the way through. The second book, which was called Total Control, I actually didn't buy in hardcover, and it took me a long time to read it when I did buy it in paperback because of the subject matter. I'm not really much for books or movies that deal with plane crashes, and I seem to recall that Total Control, the beginning of the book is there's a plane crash and somebody dies, and then there, you know, one of the there's somebody on board amongst a lot of people who dies, but one of the characters on board, I think it's his wife, who finds out that he was on board and what he was doing there. And then it goes through this whole more, you know, Washington, D.C. government intrigue and espionage. And when I did finally read it, I enjoyed it. And that was the incentive to keep reading. I'm not going to go through all of the books that Baldacci's written because he's got so many different series of books, whether there'll be The Camel Club involving a character named Oliver Stone, who is obviously an alias for a former government operative, which I think that was three or four books in the series, which was really enjoyable. And then there was the books that I've already discussed involving John Poehler, Army CID officer. There's the books involving King and Maxwell, which have been now developed into the TV show. And now the Will Robey books, there are two, which includes this latest one called The Hit. They're all solid threes. The best way that I can describe a David Baldacci book is it's a solid three on a scale of 1 to 5. It's, you know what you're going to get. You're going to get a fast read with very short chapters. Each book is maybe 450 pages long with 100 chapters, so you can do 4 or 5 chapters in a sitting. It's going to move fast. It's going to have some interesting combat hand-to-hand type stuff, some twists and turns, and at the end of it, you're going to feel a little bit of a letdown by its conclusion. But when you consider it, it's sort of like golf. You know, a bad day at golf is better than the best day at work. You know, a bad read with David Baldacci is better than taking a chance on something that you might actually dislike significantly, such as, you know, Kenneth Cameron's The Frightened Man, which was so disappointing, and other books that I've read this year, which were equally as disappointing. So the where I'm at right now, though, as far as the David Baldacci is, do I keep reading them? There are times when I will read authors for the sake of just continuing to read them to say that I've kept up with every book along the series. I was truly dedicated to the John Grisham novels. And then sometime around the last 7, 8, 9 years, I've just stopped reading them. I found that they were each equally as disappointing as the other. I didn't find that any of them were as dramatically impactful as some of his earlier novels. And that, coupled with my decided intent of trying to stay away from legal thrillers due to my profession and wanting to be able to walk away from the office when I'm not at the office, I stopped reading the John Grisham books. And I don't feel like I've missed anything from it. Sure, I feel, you know, a particular responsibility to a Jonathan Kellerman. I felt the same responsibility to a David Baldacci. But when you look at a Baldacci who's into his 20-something book and you compare it to a Michael Connelly who's into his 20-something book, somehow or other, Michael Connelly still manages to keep the characters fresh, keep the suspense, keep the darkness about the stories palpable, that Baldacci seems to have an equal or a similar ability to keep his stories mediocre. I don't know if that is something that if he were to set his mind to it and say, I'm not going to put out two books this year, I'm going to put out one great book, could he do better? I don't know. It's not that they're bad. It's just that they're not terrific. They're not gripping. There's nothing about it that screams, drop everything and read me now. And so in the future, I guess the decision that I'm going to have to make is, do I pick up a Baldacci the day it comes out, and do I put it on my shelf and let it sit there for 2 months until I get around to reading it, or do I just not do it, you know, and maybe go to something else, find a new set of books, find, you know, again, you'll notice from the beginning of the year, I've tried to read more books by brand new people and authors I've never read before, and the vast majority of them have been disappointing. So the question is, do I take up a book that I've never read, or an author I've never read before, and run the risk that it's bad, or do I just pick up another David Baldacci and know it's not going to be great, but know it's also not going to be as terrible as potentially some of these other unknown authors may be? I don't know. You know, by comparison, one of the other books I read in the last few weeks was the latest by Carl Hiaasen called Bad Monkey. And Carl Hiaasen, by comparison, doesn't write two books a year. I think he writes one book every 2, 3, or 4 years. And so when his book comes out, it's really a it's kind of an event for me, because it's something that you're clamoring for when it's gone, and you have to wait a long time for the next release. And now Carl Hiaasen has been writing some children's books here and there, and I read one of them and then decided I just didn't need to read any more of the younger kids' books. Just even though it was a Carl Hiaasen, I didn't need to read it. It was much more catered towards children and had you know, kids' themes and things like that. But this last one, Bad Monkey, was just a welcome return to Carl Hiaasen's form. And if you're not familiar with Carl Hiaasen, or your only experience with Carl Hiaasen is having seen that crappy Demi Moore movie, Striptease, then unfortunately you're truly at a disadvantage, and might even be deprived, because he is just a terrific, terrific writer. He writes wonderful satire, fantastic comedy, and all of his books take place in the south of Florida, which is his home. He lives and still writes as a reporter in Miami. I think it's Miami. And his books all follow a similar type of a pattern. And it's a pattern that's predictable. It's certainly a pattern that, you know, you get used to over the course of the books. But the pattern is really secondary. Hiaasen's books are typically focusing on some sort of a political viewpoint. And not to say that they're heavily steeped in politics, but they're mostly political issues that involve life in Florida, whether one of them was the development of the theme parks. That was a book he wrote called Native Tongue. There was a one that was obviously Striptease, the one that had to do with a plastic surgeon, this most recent one, Bad Monkey, has to do with development of you know, condos and apartments on the Keys, at Key West, the Florida Keys, and the growth of new residents who are basically not allowing the preservation of the lands. And so, okay, well, sorry about that. Cried. There's a problem. You know, you try and find a good time to talk and record, thinking that everybody's asleep, you got some time to yourself, and then your 7.5-year-old comes in and says she can't sleep, you have to pause everything, and you lose track of where you are. So anyways, I think I was talking about Carl Hyacin. So his books are always have some sort of a focus on a political topic, you know, centered around Florida. And this one, as I think I mentioned, deals with the development of properties on the Keys, and the need to, or, you know, Hyacin's focus is preservation of the areas and, you know, keeping them as pristine as they would normally be, and not letting them be developed by money hungry, you know, wackos, basically. And so the way that all of Hyacin's book follow this pattern is it usually starts out with some sort of a weird, bizarre type of an incident. And in this case, it's two tourists who are in Florida who go on a fishing boat, you know, one of these go sport fishing tourism type things. And they, during the course of their fishing, they don't hook a fish, they hook a severed arm. And it just you know, rolls from there. It kind of snowballs out of control from there. All the characters are fantastical. None of them are founded in any type of reality. You would sit there and say, these people can't really exist. These types of people can't really exist. The bad guys are always so silly and crazy, with deformities or self-inflicted wounds that cause deformities. And I know I'm speaking so abstractly that if you're not familiar with the Hyacin book, it doesn't mean a whole lot to you. But it really, the books always seem to exaggerate the villainy to the point where it's comedic, so that you don't really feel bad when the bad guys get what's due to them. In fact, they typically get their just desserts in a comedic or bizarre type of a way. And the true testament of a Carl Hyacin's talent is his ability to craft these bizarre incidents that, I mean, I could sit there, I'd never come up with some of these things. I'd never come up with the guy who is the jilted ex-husband who doesn't pay spousal support, who gets all jacked up on alcohol and painkillers and falls asleep in a sugarcane field and then gets run over by a thresher. I'd never, and I think that's how one of the characters met their demise in Striptease. I'd never, ever be able to come up with something like that. And in fact, the way that this guy, the bad guy in Bad Monkey, comes up with his just desserts is equally as comedic and fascinating. You know, the characters are so bizarre. They're so strange. One of the characters in Bad Monkey is an actual monkey who, the legend is, was in the Pirates of the Caribbean movies with Johnny Depp, but he was kicked off the set because of, believe me, you got to read what the conduct was of this monkey, why he got kicked off of the movie. Just completely ridiculously bizarre. The characters are all caricatures of, they're cartoon characters, basically. And it's really enjoyable to read a Hyacin novel because you know you're getting a little bit of politics. You know you're getting a bent. You know you're getting Carl Hyacin's take on certain of these issues that affect Florida inhabitants. But at the same time, you also know that you're going to get just great comedy, great dialogue, characters which are so bizarre as to be comedic just all by themselves, and just a good time. And so it's unfortunate that he doesn't write more novels, that he only puts out one every 2 to 3 years, I guess, is what it may be. I remember one of the things that initially drew me to the Carl Hyacin books, I think I picked up one of the books called Skin Tight in the supermarket, and I don't even know how long ago that was. I'm looking at the front of the book right now to look at the books that Hyacin's written, and it looks like it was 10 books back at this point. So we're talking about probably 15, 18, maybe even 20 years ago that I picked it up. And one of the things that I liked about the book was that after the events had transpired and the book was basically concluded, he ended the book with an epilogue. And the epilogue was little paragraphs about each of the characters in the book. So you got a little bit of blurb about what happened to him after the events in the book had concluded. And I always thought that was kind of a cool thing because he was so creative in what happened to these characters. And even the minor characters or the characters who showed up once and then you never saw again, he still would have a little bit of a two or three sentence blurb about what happened to him. And for a couple books in a row, he kept that consistent in Striptease and Native Tongue and some of the other ones. He seems like he's gotten away from that. He hasn't done that so much lately. But one of the other things about the Carl Hyson books, I mean, he creates a character who shows up in numerous of the books, and he's the former governor, I think he's the former governor of the state of Florida, who went into hiding. I mean, he just kind of disappeared after his tenure as governor was over. And he now interacts with the main characters of whichever book he appears in. And he's described as a, if I recall correctly, he hasn't shown up in a few books in a while now, but he's like a wild man with a crazy beard and crazy hair. Looks like a homeless person. In fact, I think he is basically homeless. You know, and he eats muskrat and roadkill, and he's got a glass eye, and he wears a shower cap. And he goes by the name of Skink. I think his name is Skink, Skink. Just bizarre. I mean, I think he has a sidekick, and the sidekick insists on calling him governor or something like that. And it's one of those things where you don't. I never like to reread books. I don't believe in rereading books. My feeling is there's too many books out there I haven't read. Why would I want to take time to read a book I've already read when I can read something I haven't read? But just to go back to some of these earlier Hyacinth books, definitely Skin Tight, Striptease, Native Tongue, a couple others. I think there's one called Tourist Season and Double Whammy, Stormy Weather. They're just so, so funny. And the characters in them are just so amusing that you can't help but read it with a huge smile on your face. This guy, Hyacinth, is a true master of satire. And it's unfortunate that the only movie that they made out of his book, Striptease, really didn't translate well. And let's talk about that movie just real quick. It got a lot of negative attention because of Demi Moore and her breast enhancements and all that kind of stuff. And this is my take on it. I just don't think that the public was ready for that movie. It was actually pretty faithful to the book, if I recall correctly. It really was. But it's something that maybe translates much better in book form than it does in a movie, because when it translates onto the screen, you have people who are incapable of dealing with the subject matters and would instead like to focus on the aspects of it that make them uncomfortable. The fact that they were strippers, the whole thing with Showgirls, whether Showgirls was a good movie or a bad movie, which, you know, it was pretty crappy. The fact that it involves strippers and the dancing and you know, you get to the point where you wonder whether anybody could really be a good actress by playing a stripper, and the scenes of the stripping were, you know, at times gratuitous, and so it takes away from the story. And in Striptease, it really had a good story, and it had wonderful characters who were creatively disturbed and comedic. And when you put too many well-known names into the movie, such as a Burt Reynolds and a Ving Rhames and a Demi Moore, it takes away from the story of it. And so if you'd seen the movie, or if you stayed away from the movie because of those things, I mean, my recommendation would be to pick up the book and read it. Or if you saw the movie a long time ago, you don't remember it, pick up the book and read it. Because when you see it on the printed page, you get a better feeling for the bizarreness of it. Is that a word? Bizarreness? For really the it's a circus of freaks type of a thing. And you get a much better understanding not only of the characters and their wacko-ness, But also the serious aspects of it involving the main character and her child and the other political aspects of the book itself. So that's just my statement on Carl Hiaasen and Striptease and all of his books basically as they are. If they make any other books into movies, any other books into movies, I think it would be interesting. But I'm not sure which of them would really translate well. I just don't know. There's some books that, as you read them, you can picture them happening and you can picture them as being directly translatable into film. And there are other books that you read them and say, I just don't think it would have the same impact or have the same it just wouldn't translate well onto the screen. And I think a Carl Hiaasen book, it because the characters are so cartoonish and so outlandish, I think that it would be difficult to translate that into the screen and not lose sight of Carl Hiaasen's capability of creating such fantastical characters and such unique situations and certainly unique methods of demise for the bad guys. But as long as he's writing books, I will continue to read them. They are certainly that enjoyable. Now, the last book that I read that I wanted to talk about is a book called Now You See Me by S.J. Bolton. And it's the first book in a series. And what initially drew me to this book was that it's supposedly a modern-day Jack the Ripper. So right there, as we discussed in some of the previous episodes, that's an aspect that kind of has been fascinating to me of late. And so I somehow got, through Amazon, another recommendation that this might be a book that I'd like, and so I picked it up. And it was good. So the story is that a character who's a police detective in London named Lacey Flint, she finds a woman who's murdered at her on her car, basically. She walks out to her car, and there's a woman there, and she's been murdered. And this is the first in a series of murders that all seem to be related to the Jack the Ripper killings. Now, it takes place in present day, late 2000s, I guess, is when it was written, so present day. And the way that we know that they're related to the Jack the Ripper murders is because the killer is sending messages to Lacey directly. So we know that Lacey is somehow involved with the killer. The victims themselves are not specifically the same names as Jack the Ripper's victims, but the timing of the murders and the methods of the murders are distinctly similar to the Jack the Ripper killings. So even though Lacey is a witness to the first murder, she also has to participate in the investigation because she's the one who is being contacted by the murderer, and just by circumstance, she also happens to be an expert in the Jack the Ripper killings themselves, having thoroughly studied them and thus being the detective who briefs all of the other cadre of detectives working on the murders as to the circumstances of the Jack the Ripper killings. So, you know, it has that immediate draw, this immediate pull into the story, and you know that she's involved somehow. You know that at the end you'll get to figure out, you'll learn what her connection is to the murderer and why the murderer was targeting her. You're also not sure whether she's actually going to be a potential victim or not. Then you just kind of find that out as you go through the book. I thought that the book dragged at times, but for the most part, I thought it really kept my interest. But here's where I had some difficulty with the book, and it actually, it's not just this book, but with other books that have similar types of story structures. This book felt a lot to me like books that I read by Tana French, and some of you may be aware of Tana French. She's a very popular author. I think she's written 4 or 5 books now that all take place up in, I think, Ireland, and they're the Murder Squad, or Ireland, I think is what it is. And I read 2 of them. The first one was called Into the Woods, and the second one was called The Likeness. And they don't necessarily have the exact same characters, but they have I think it's the same universe of characters. So I think that the characters of each of the 4 books don't necessarily interact with each other in every book, but they're all part of the same same world that Tana French has created. So at some point, I would imagine that she's going to write a book that's going to bring these characters all back together. The first book, Into the Woods, I didn't particularly like that much. I liked it enough to want to read the second book, and I know that it was a big successful book, and a lot of reviewers put it on their lists. It basically follows two detectives, a man and a woman, if I recall correctly, who are investigating either the murder, the disappearance of kids out of woods outside Dublin, I think it is, a small town. And the strange connection is that the man who's part of the detective team, when he was a child, he was part of a group of kids who went missing. And I think he's the only one that survived. And the whereabouts of the other two or three kids who were with him is still unknown and was like an open, unsolved mystery. So the connections or the similarities between the disappearance of the kids that the detective was involved in and the disappearance of the kids that he and his partner are investigating currently is what draws the parallels. What I didn't like about the book is that at the end of it, the earlier mystery was not resolved. And if it was resolved, it was resolved in a way that I was just ignorant of. I just didn't get it. And when I read some of the online posts about it, I think it was pretty clear that other people either didn't get it or also noticed that that mystery was not resolved. And it's okay if you're going to leave a mystery unresolved at the end of a book, but the expectation is that you're going to stay with these characters and you're going to bring them around to the point where at some point you're going to resolve that mystery. And I immediately after Into the Woods picked up the second book called The Likeness and found out that it's not a continuation of the first book. It's not a continuation of that mystery. In fact, that mystery seems to just stays, unfinished business from the first book. And now we're into the second book called The Likeness, which involves a different character completely. I don't even remember if it was the girl who was the girl from the guy-girl team in the first book. I don't remember. And to me, it doesn't really matter. But the second book is the one that I want to talk about. It's called The Likeness, and it's told by the main character, the woman. It's in first person. And what I seem to think that, if I recall correctly, the story of the book is a woman has been murdered, and they don't know anything about her. She's got no ID. They're not able to really learn a whole lot about why she was killed. And in fact, I don't think very many people even know that she was killed. But this detective seems to bear a striking similarity in appearance to the murdered woman. And so the police decide that what they're going to do is they're going to send the murdered woman back. They're going to send her into the dead woman, the detective who looks like the murdered woman. She's going to be sent back into the murdered woman's life to resume life so that that might provide her with information about who killed her likeness, basically. A little bit bizarre, I will grant you that, but it actually kind of a compelling idea. But what you get when you have these books that are told from the first person is you never know whether your narrator is reliable or not. And I've mentioned this before, this concept of the unreliable narrator. You never know until the end if the narrator has been reliable. And if it's done well, if it's done to precision, then when you get to the end of the book and you realize that all this time your narrator has been unreliable, it's really a big mind screw, because then you have to go back through the whole book and try and recreate what about the story was true, how much of it was your narrator being honest with you about, and how much of it was your narrator just messing with you. A good example of that is the Tal Goldberg book that I mentioned before, Living Dead Girl. That was just, you read the book and you don't know what's going on as far as your narrator. You don't know whether to trust him or not. And when you get to the end of it and you realize that all along you've been duped, you've been misled, you've been, brought down this path only to be slapped in the face with a recognition that you've been lied to, it's really a good, it's really a shocking moment to behold. And in the likeness, I didn't feel like that really came out so well. I mean, we knew that our narrator along the way, well, no, I take that back. I thought that our narrator was, in the likeness, was pretty straightforward. She was telling us like it was, or telling like it was. She had nothing to do with this whole, this woman and all that. But as the story went on and we saw how that character was changing, it became apparent that she, as she was changing, she wasn't telling us everything. And so when it was over and we realized that there were things that she was withholding, it didn't have that same shock level of like the Todd Goldberg book. It just didn't. And so it was, it to me, it came down a little flat. And that's the problem that I had with the S.J. Bolton book, Now You See Me. Because she drops subtle hints throughout the book that she knows more than she's telling you. In fact, at one point, I think she says, at the end of one of the chapters or at the end of one of the major sections of the book, she says, and it was clear that the murderer was me. Okay, well, we know the murderer is not you, but you're going to say something cryptic like that. You know, give us a little bit something to you know, let us in on it. Let us in on it. When I read other books that are told in first person, like when the Harry Bosch novels are told in first person, or obviously the Alex Delaware books with Jonathan Kellerman, those are told in first person. When the Jack Reacher books are told in first person, there's no doubt that you're being given the entire story. There's no question that, you know, you don't sit there and say, well, am I really being told everything, or is this guy really, you know, misleading me, or is he deliberately trying to, you know, draw me down a path and only to you know, flip the tables on me later? You never really have that sense of foreboding about the twist that's going to happen at the end. In this book, you kind of felt it, but I'm going to be honest as to why I didn't believe that she was going to be a typical unreliable narrator. It's because I know that there have been other books with the same character since this one. This one, Now You See Me, is the first in a series, and I think there's been two or three other books involving the same character. And it's interesting to me, I haven't read enough books that have unreliable narrators to know whether it's customary for those characters to simply evaporate after the book is concluded, or whether those characters will continue into other books. And it seems to me that you have that the author has a challenge of continuing a series of books when the author has already identified the narrator as unreliable, especially if the books are told in first person. So you have, you have your book, and it's told in first person. You got your unreliable narrator, and all the while through the book, you're believing everything you're being told, just to have the narrator turn the tables on you at the end. Now you start questioning the integrity of the narrator, and that's fine for one book. That's fine when you get to that end of that book, and then you rethink the whole story after you've now been told what the truth is and that your narrator was lying to you. But once that's been established, how do you then go into book two or book three with the same narrator, not having the same concern that you're being lied to? And that presents a challenge to the author. Two challenges. Challenge number one is, if you're going to continue to have your narrator be unreliable, how many times are you going to be able to go to that same well and have the narrator turn the tables on your reader? How often can you do that? How many secrets can there be that this character will have that will be revealed in a, you know, shocking conclusion at the end of each book? I don't know that you could keep this going for 5, 10, 15, 30 books. I just don't see that possible. So that's challenge number one, is the author going to continue to want this narrator to be unreliable? If the author does not intend for your narrator, for his or her narrator to continue to be unreliable, then the second challenge, or the alternative challenge, is you got to find a way to reestablish your character's credibility with your reader, because you've already demonstrated to your reader that the narrator cannot be trusted, that there is a difficulty in telling the truth, or that they're going to selectively dole out information to you only as they feel that it's necessary for you to receive it. So how do you rebuild that credibility and say, hey, reader, that was a one-time thing. I messed with your head once. Now we're square. Now we're going to play it straight. Now you don't have to worry about the narrator lying to you ever again. We're going to be real transparent. We're going to be open and honest about everything. Keep reading. And this is my new heroine. And enjoy. I don't know. That's a challenge to me. And so that was why, not having had any experience with other unreliable narrators who ended up being characters in successive books, I didn't have any reason to think that this character was going to be unreliable. And the conclusion that really highlights the unreliability is something which is so dramatic that it really makes you question this character's ability to tell the truth. Really, I mean, the conclusion was so shocking, and not shocking in a way that it was like, oh, I didn't see that coming. Yeah, I didn't see that coming. Was it really significant? No, it wasn't really significant. And the reason why is because the reveal was of incidents that really only were brought to the reader's attention within the last 50 to 100 pages. So what that means is, for the first two-thirds of the book, you're treating this character and the investigation as a straightforward murder mystery, and then you learn a little bit more background, which gives rise to understanding why these particular murders were happening and what the connections between them were, and then you find out the reveal about the main character. And it's not like, you know, she's been lying to you from day one. You realize that she didn't really know that she was being unreliable to you until towards the end, if that makes sense. It's not something that, to put it another way, in Living Dead Girl by Todd Goldberg, I believe that the narrator was trying to be deliberately misleading the entire book. And if he wasn't attempting to be deliberately misleading the entire book, it was because he had psychological problems of his own. In Now You See Me, I don't believe that the main character, that Lacey, intended to deliberately mislead the reader, because I don't believe that her secret, so to speak, had anything to do with the murders. And so she wasn't trying to be misleading. It had nothing to do with anything. But as the mystery revealed itself, and as the motives behind the murders became more apparent, or as Lacey learned of them, then I think she deliberately tried to conceal her own backstory to mislead the reader. But so, having said all that, I didn't expect her to be misleading. And now the question is, how does Lacey Flint appear in book two? Does she come off as equally misleading? Does she come off as equally unreliable? Do I, as the reader, have an immediate chip on my shoulder of, I can't believe a word of what's being said? I can't. I have to take everything that's said with a grain of salt. And that, to me, proves to be a distraction. Because I don't think that the author wants the reader to question the narrator, especially when the author is creating a story which has an unreliable narrator. As I mentioned, if it's done well, the resolution, or the realization that the narrator is unreliable, should come as a huge shock that takes you aback. You should have no preconceived expectations, or you should have no thoughts during the reading of the story that your narrator is unreliable. But now, with Lacey Flint's second book, the question is, will I start reading it with the belief that she's unreliable? And if I do have that belief, will I be more focused on whether or not she's unreliable and lose sight of whatever the true story is? And I imagine it's another murder mystery. I haven't really looked into it yet. So that's an interesting question. And it's another one of those you know, mind flip type of a things. But I think it's truly, it can be a risk for the author. It can be a risk for the author to create a character who is misleading in one and then tries to immediately establish new credibility with you and say, hey, all that stuff about being misleading and about, you know, the lies in the past, that's all in the past, and now I'm going to be straightforward with you and I'm not going to tell you any more lies. I don't know. I would say that that's something that I'm interested in following up on, but then I go back to Now You See Me and I say, okay, well, the book was good, but was it good enough for me to want to read another book? Because the voice of the character Lacey, I found to be very similar to the voice of the main character in the Tana French book, The Likeness, and I really didn't like that voice. Now I'm going to confess something here that you've learned about me already if you've been listening. I have a difficult time with women authors. This one, Now You See Me, was written by a woman. The Likeness by Tana French was written by a woman. I read both of them on my Kindle. And so it was easy for me to simply allow the feeling of the language to encompass me in the same way. And what that means is I could picture the two characters from Likeness and Now You See Me as the same character, both, you know, police inspectors or detectives or whatever it was, investigating murder, both, you know, in Great Britain or you know, the British Isles. So I could feel the same reaction to the writing in this book as I did with the Tana French book, and I really didn't like that Tana French feel. I didn't like the way it felt. It felt like there was a constant pulsing, if that makes any sense. It felt as if the language was passive, not terribly dramatic, but with a heartbeat that made you think, or made me think, that it was building up to something. And that's a talent, but it also is a talent, I guess, if that's what your intention is as a writer. For me, I felt that it sometimes created a drag. I definitely felt that in The Likeness, that the book dragged. There were long periods, it seemed, where nothing specifically great happened, or nothing particularly exciting happened. Definitely in The Likeness, I felt that. Now You See Me, I felt that as well. I don't remember the book being that long, maybe 350 pages, but I do recall at some parts really feeling like I had to push to get through to something else exciting. There were a lot of chapters, which helps to move the book along, but somehow, even though there were something like 80 or 90 chapters, it still felt like each chapter was a chore to sometimes get through. And so I don't know if that's a characteristic of the female writer. I don't know. I'd like to think that's not. I don't know that I particularly liked Lacey as a character anyways, besides the fact that she lied to us, besides the fact there was this reveal at the end, prior to the discovery that she was unreliable. I don't think I really liked her that much. She's damaged, but not, you know, and I don't want to say that her being damaged is what was detracted from my liking her, because all of the characters that I read are in some way or another damaged. I take that back. Alex Delaware is pretty much not damaged at all. Harry Bosch is definitely damaged. Mickey Howler's definitely damaged. But I couldn't relate to Lacey Flint's damage. I couldn't relate to what was, you know, her issues. She was at some point homeless. She drug used, prostitution, continued to even in the current state. While she's a police detective, she still goes off in the middle of the night to go find random guys to hook up with. I couldn't relate to that, and that was it. Really separated me from the book at times. So there was that distance that was created. The murderer, who the person who committed the murders, I thought was pretty inventive. The murders themselves were pretty terrifying as they were characterized in the book. The ending was a little bit confusing because of the location of where the reveal took place and where the bad guy was captured. It seemed to be a little bit confusing because I don't know the area so well, and I didn't think that the descriptions of the locales were that great because I think it was like underneath the river and in tunnels and things like that. So it was a little bit deceptive. It was a little bit unclear as to how that was revealed, and it actually seemed to take too long to get to that point. You know, the tunnels that the main character had to go through and how she got here to there to here to there to here to there. It seemed to just unnecessarily drag the ending out a little bit too long. But I don't know. I might pick up the second book just to see if the character continues in the vein of being dishonest. Be interesting to see if the second book, if it starts with Lacey, you know, confessing to her earlier dishonesty and coming clean with the reader. I might pick up the book just to see that. It, you know, look, a 350 page book isn't a lot of skin off my back. It's another week or so of reading, so I don't mind picking it up just to check it out. It's just an interesting analysis of this unreliable narrator, and the problem is you can't go to your friends or go to your book club or go to Amazon or whatever it is and try and find a book that has an unreliable narrator. Because if you know ahead of time that it's got an unreliable narrator, then you're already distanced from the story. As I said, the key to a successful unreliable narrator is the F you at the end that you feel when you get to the reveal. When you find out that your mind has just been screwed with the whole time. I'll give you a teaser for the next episode. One of the books that I read a few years ago, which I really, really enjoyed, was a book called Drood by Dan Simmons. And I picked it up because the name Drood certainly is associated with the Charles Dickens novel The Mystery of Edwin Drood, which was unfinished at the time of his death. I'd seen the musical on Broadway 20-something years ago, hadn't read anything else about it, never read The Mystery of Edwin Drood itself, but having seen this book at the bookstore, I picked it up, and I'll get to a little bit more of that story in the next episode, but I remember when the book ended, I don't remember really much about the book at all, but I remember when the book ended, I sat back, closed the book, and went, oh my God, the author was messing with me this whole time. And that's the kind of feel that you want to have when you have an unreliable narrator. The problem is, if you know that the narrator is unreliable, that aha is gone. The mystery of it is gone for you. So I can't say to my friends out there, hey, you guys know of any books where there's been this unreliable narrator? Because if they say, yeah, read this, well, guess what? Now I know that's an unreliable narrator. So I guess what I'll do is, you know, just keep doing what we're doing. You know, keep reading. And if I come up with any new books which have this unreliable narrator to it, I will certainly keep you apprised of it. But that's that. Next time, I think we'll spend the next episode on the book I'm reading now. I teased it last time, and I'm not going to tease it anymore now, other than to say I've got about 115 pages left. It's about 615 pages left. It's about 620 pages. I got about 150 pages left. And I am very close, depending upon how it ends. And I don't want to jinx it. I'm knocking on wood. I don't want to jinx it. It could be one of the best books I've ever read. So that's it for Book Therapy. I'm Rob Cohen, and thanks for letting me lie on your couch.